You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 14th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
How far right might Europe turn at looming EU Parliament elections? As Denmark starts calling up women, should the rest of Europe be shuffling towards a war footing? And can card games make you better at politics, or vice versa? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Marta Lorimer and Robin Lustig will discuss the day's big stories, and we'll have a report from MIPIM as the world's leading property fair gets underway in Cannes. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Marta Lorimer, Fellow in European Politics at the London School of Economics, and by Robin Lustig, journalist and broadcaster, former presenter of The World Tonight on Radio 4. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Hi.
Marta, am I right, first of all, in suspecting a deeply sinister ulterior motive in your suggestion that we shortly discuss the possible rise of the far right in Europe?
Well, it just so happens that I have a book coming out couple of weeks.
Do you?
Yes, it's such a coincidence, isn't it?
Would you like to mention the title?
Of course. The title is Europe as Ideological Resource, European Integration and Far-Right Legitimation in France and Italy. So it's about Italy, France, the far-right and European integration, everything we're talking about tonight.
Who is publishing that?
Oxford University Press.
Okay, and will it be in a reputable bookstore near most of our listeners?
If it's an academic reputable bookstore, I guess so. Otherwise, the internet is there to help you.
We may mention that book again once or twice throughout the program. We should have a little bell that we could ting every time you insert an artless reference to the title. We've had a couple of guests in the past, I will name no names, who actually you end up kind of wanting to applaud the number of times they're able to shoehorn the title of their own book in. Robin, as we were discussing shortly before going on air, you have not recently been writing any books, but you have been to the movies.
Yes, I have been to the movies. I don't often go to the movies these days. I sort of got out of the habit during the COVID pandemic, but I've been twice in a week, which is very unusual. And I saw two really interesting films. One was called Zone of Interest, which is about the guy who was the commander at the Auschwitz death camp during the Holocaust. But what's interesting about it is that it doesn't show Auschwitz. It's just about his family life, and it's really very odd.
It's an interesting technique, isn't it? I haven't seen it yet, but does it proceed on the assumption that we all at this point have kind of got the idea visually where Auschwitz is concerned? Our imaginations will fill in the background.
Yes, and there's just a little bit of help for your imagination. There's a very high wall, and there is a most amazing sound design, so you hear the camp, even though you never see it. You hear dogs barking, you hear shouts, you occasionally hear gunshots, and then, of course, you see columns of smoke coming out of chimneys. So it's all very understated, but, you know, for somebody like me as a journalist, to make a film about something that you can't see, make a film about something that isn't happening on screen is very counterintuitive. And the other film I saw is a Japanese film called Perfect Days, which is simply about a Tokyo toilet cleaner whose perfect days are the same every day, and he goes around cleaning toilets, and absolutely nothing else happens. And it's very odd indeed. I wasn't totally convinced.
But you enjoyed this, because this is on the face of an unenticing pitch.
It's a very unenticing pitch, but it's Wim Wenders' film, who is a great filmmaker, and I was intrigued by it. I really was, and I recommend that people should go and see it.
Well, let's start with those European elections and the prospect of the rise of the far right, which somebody really should write some sort of book about. A little less than 3 months from now, the European Union will stage its contribution to 2024's overcrowded election calendar. Enjoyers of bleak irony, if arguably nobody else, will appreciate that voting, which begins on June the 6th, is widely predicted to go some way to reversing the progress made against Europe's far right tendencies, which which began on that date 80 years previously. That was an extremely laboured D-Day reference, worth a try on balance, I thought. Polls do indeed suggest that far-right parties are poised to do well, and that parties associated with the European Parliament's Identity and Democracy faction, which includes France's National Rally, Germany's AfD, and the Netherlands' Ascendant Freedom Party, may entrench themselves as the Parliament's third largest grouping. Marta, first of all, is there any chance this doesn't happen, that the polls are overselling the far right?
There is some chance that this doesn't happen, as predicted by the polls as they are right now. But it is still quite likely that the far right is going to do well in these elections. So with European Parliament elections in particular, most people will make up their minds much closer to the election. Some of them don't even know if they're going to show up and vote. So it is still a bit difficult to make any kind of judgment call in terms of where it's going. But considering what the general trend in terms of the rise of the far right has been in the last few years, it is quite likely that they're going to do well.
This is a question, Robin, to which it does strike me that there's probably a short answer as well as a long answer, which is the question of why this is happening. Is it basically as simple and fundamental as the fact that a hefty plurality of the European public just doesn't like immigration very much?
I think that's something to do with it. But I also think one has to keep a sense of perspective. As you know, Andrew, I've got quite a long memory on these things. My first job as a foreign correspondent was as a Reuters correspondent based in Spain in the early 1970s, when Spain was run by a fascist dictator by the name of General Francisco Franco. Portugal was also run by a fascist dictator. Greece was being run by a military junta.
People forget how recent this was in Europe, don't they?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was already quite grown up at this time. all of Central and Eastern Europe was under the sway of the Soviet Union, were being run by communist dictatorships. We've come a long way since then. And when we talk about the far right doing well, possibly, in European elections, we're talking about them getting, what, maximum 25% of the vote?
That's what it's looking
We're talking like. About maximum the new European Parliament having nearly half, perhaps, of its MPs coming from either the right or the far right. We're not talking about a sweeping majority of people voting for extreme nationalist groups.
The recurrent question, Marta, well, a recurrent question is, is there any way at all that what we think of as relatively, you know, sensible mainstream politicians can do to combat this and to let some of the air out of the far right? Is there, whether accidentally or otherwise, a recurrent theme where, say, your archetypal sensible centrist, you might think of President Emmanuel Macron of France, ends up actually enabling a creature, for example, like Marine Le Pen?
Yeah, I mean, this is a big part of the problem, is that some mainstream parties have been learning the wrong lessons from the far right success. What they think is that the way to combat the far right is to copy their policies, which isn't exactly the best way to go about it. If you do genuinely want to fight the far right, then you have to put together or put forward policies that are actually going to make people's lives better. And that way you're going to be able to get at least some of the more peripheral far-right voters. There's a core of far-right voters that are not going to be persuaded until you close down the border and kick all immigrants out. But there are a lot of other people who vote for the far-right for other reasons, including that they feel that at this point it's the only alternative they haven't tried, who might be swayed by policies that improve the quality of their life.
Is there a related problem to that, Robin, the fact that there will always be the hardcore who will never be happy, but they tend to be extremely voluble and often quite organised? And one thinks certainly in the UK, which obviously no longer participates in EU elections, largely because of that faction who just will not be happy until the Channel Tunnel is bricked up. But they benefit, do they not, from low turnout? And in 2019, I mean, some of the turnouts in European elections are almost comically low. 28% in the Czech Republic, 23% in Slovakia, 31% in Portugal, 42% in the Netherlands. I mean, listeners familiar with the programme at this point can take as read my enthusiasm for compulsory voting. But they do benefit from the fact that quite a lot of people in quite a lot of electorates simply cannot be bothered.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think both low turnout and a vote for the far right stem from a similar root cause, which is a very deep disillusion with established democratic politics and what it has delivered over the past couple of decades. We've been through economic crisis after economic crisis. We now have a war in Europe, Ukraine. We have a large immigration issue which hasn't been properly dealt with. And so you have a substantial core of disillusioned voters who are either have given up altogether on the democratic idea or believe that the established parties can no longer offer them anything worth taking and therefore they'll look for something new.
Marta, just finally on this, and another seamless plug coming up here. It's not necessarily the most pleasant of prospects by way of a remedy, but is there something to be said for just kind of hoping that at some level the extremist parties get into power, demonstrate that they're not actually terribly good at governing, and hope the lesson sort of gets across to the voters? And the seamless plug I'm about to do is for the new issue of Monocle magazine, which contains an interview I did with Greece's Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, in which he said, obviously, in Greece, the populists were of a leftward orientation rather than a rightward one. But he did say, with a certain amount of affected modesty, but he's entitled to it, that when his party or his government came to power, he said, we had the advantage that the populists had had a go at governing.
This is a bit, it's a very early 2000s thing to say, in a sense.
Because, I'm an early 2000s kind of guy. What can I tell you?
I suppose this was the established consensus after the Austrian Freedom Party's first experience in government, where they didn't do very well and they lost a huge amount of votes afterwards. The problem is that the far right has since become a lot more competent in terms of when they exert power. Them not being very successful in government doesn't always result in them losing a lot of votes. And this is basically because at this point there is a fairly solid core of voters that will still stay with them. So yes, their being in government can reveal sometimes that they're not the best, but they can also do fairly well in government sometimes. They can treat government as an opportunity, just keep campaigning. This is what Matteo Salvini famously did. Not to great results right now. So essentially, sometimes it might reveal something about their complete lack of competence. Other times, you just have a far-right party in government that has a few years to do whatever it is that they want with power.
Poland is an interesting example, though, isn't it, of one country which looked as if the far-right really was established, but in fact it was defeated.
And I remember one friend of mine in Warsaw saying before the election, part of the problem with combating the Law and Justice Party is that they do actually get the bins collected and make sure the potholes are filled.
But it wasn't enough.
Apparently not.
Not after 8 years, but it served them fairly well for a couple of terms.
Well, sticking with cheery portents of Europe's near future, Denmark has announced plans to begin conscripting women for the first time and to extend the standard period of compulsory military service from 4 months to 11, along with which Denmark will spend the equivalent of an additional €5.5 billion, give or take, on defence over the next 5 years. This is the latest step in a readily explicable ramping up of European defences since 2022, but is a stint in uniform going to become once again a pretty common rite of passage? This was Sir Richard Shirriff, retired British general and NATO's former Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe, speaking to Monocle Radio in January.
Frankly, conscription to a professional soldier is anathema. It is the last thing a professional soldier needs or wants. And the British Army particularly has a long tradition of long service, volunteers of enormous experience. The reality with the British Army, the numbers are in free fall. It's proving incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to recruit the numbers required. The generation of today's young men and women have other things to do. And it's absolutely tied to deterrence, because in order to be credible, in order to be capable, you've got to have the right people power, manpower, womanpower in your armed forces. And if you can't get it by volunteers, you have to look at other methods, which is why I say we have to think the unthinkable and consider conscription. And I think it would be unwise, frankly, to rule it out.
That was General Sir Richard Sheriff, former Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe, speaking to Monocle Radio in January. Robin, I thought his views there were interestingly nuanced. As anybody who has spent much time, certainly with British professional soldiers, knows, that they're aghast by the idea of conscription. It's the last thing they want, a bunch of scruffy riffraff clogging up their ranks. But he seems to think it may be necessary anyway.
Yes, I think, though, that the solution is the wrong one. To my mind, the reason that the UK Army, if that's what we want to talk about for a moment, has been so diminished is because that was government policy for many years, was to not fund an army.
This was the peace dividend.
It was the peace dividend. Now, unfortunately, the peace dividend is no longer there, thanks to Mr. Putin. I would say this, though, if you're going to have conscription, then I do think the Danes are right that it should apply equally to men and women. There is now no real reason why women should not play the same role in the defence of a country as men traditionally have done. I don't think conscription is the answer, and I think it's a mistake to think that having a few tens of thousands more men and women in uniform is the way to defend a country against possible future attack, because the likelihood is that future attacks will be from the air, they will be cyber attacks, they will be drone attacks. Who knows, they may even be attacks from space. They are unlikely, I think, notwithstanding what happened in the war that Russia is waging against Ukraine, to be tanks trundling across the countryside.
Marta, what do you think? Because Sir Richard was talking there about the context of a country which feels itself, rightly or wrongly, a long way away from any continental squabbles which may be occurring over on the Eastern Front. But even in Ukraine itself, a country fighting an existential battle for its own survival, they are having difficulty drumming up the requisite numbers. Does conscription start to take on kind of an inevitability, do you think?
I think after you've been at war for, at this point, over 2 years, it does become an option. But it still seems to be a less than ideal one, because, of course, what Robin was saying quite correctly is that once you have conscripts, you do have people who have not been trained for this and who might actually slow down the ones who know what they're doing. So it's a huge investment that you're making if you don't want to use them as cannon fodder, essentially. So is this the best solution? I don't know. Is there an alternative? I also don't know.
I mean, is the answer, Robin, and this does seem like a really obvious one, so I'm sure somebody clever, or I hope somebody cleverer than me has thought of it, is the answer basically to make the idea of a volunteer career in the armed forces more appealing? By which I mean, certainly when you join as an other rank, the money is other than tremendous.
That's true. I think it's an unfortunate fact of life, however, that life in the armed forces is a far more attractive proposition if you don't think you are going to go to war. I think the very real risk of ending up on the battlefront with your life at risk will make most people think quite carefully about whether this is a career they want. I've actually spent some time in army recruitment offices watching and talking to young men and women coming in to volunteer. And the last thing on their minds was that they were actually going to fire a gun in anger or be fired at in anger. They wanted to learn a trade. They wanted a good job. They liked the idea of travel. But if they thought they were going to go to war, that was a different matter.
Marta, do you buy the idea, which is often advanced in favour of conscription, that it does also work, apart from preparing a nation to defend itself, it's an engine of societal cohesion? And I can remember doing a story for Monocle years ago when I went to Switzerland, which I realise is a special case in many respects, but they do take their defence extremely seriously, and meeting a bunch, to do a story on conscription in Switzerland, and I meeting a bunch of kids who had started to do their bit quite recently, and a couple of them said things to the effect of, like, you know this is coming up if you're Swiss, and everybody whines about it and moans about it, but you get here and you're brought together with a bunch of other 19-year-olds from parts of Switzerland you haven't visited, with completely different life experiences and perspectives, and they kind of herd you towards a helicopter and say something to the effect of, right, this is now your helicopter, and the people who fly it are placing their lives in your hands every day. He said, yeah, at that point you start thinking, now is a good time to grow up a bit.
There's a one of the stories that is told about how Italy actually became a nation has to do with the wars. Basically, Italy was a very divided country, and it was famously said when it was united that now that we've made Italy, we have to make Italians. And that conscription, in fact, functioned in that way, because for the first time, Italians from southern Italy were meeting Italians from northern Italy, mm-hmm. and realizing they didn't quite speak the same language. But they had to find a way to communicate. So there certainly is a case to be made for social cohesion, but the question is, who is it that is becoming socially cohesed, in a sense? It's only a certain group of people probably that are going to experience this. At the time, it was mostly men, of course. And surely there are other ways to think about social cohesion.
Absolutely.
That don't really include, I'm going to go and die for my country. It could be, I think, in general, having a form of volunteer service of some kind, a compulsory volunteer service that can be in the military but can be somewhere else, would probably serve a very similar role, but not require that you actually at some point learn how to fire a gun.
Well, here in the UK, meanwhile, what with the digital media revolution of the last 30 years or so, the idea of banning foreign state interests from owning British media may seem like shutting the stable door when the horse is several counties distant. Nevertheless, the UK's current Conservative government is taking time out from packing to pass a law which will ban foreign governments from owning British newspapers and news magazines. This is a response to a United Arab Emirates-backed effort to buy the Daily Telegraph and the Spectator, possibly not coincidentally, the preferred reading of the Conservative Party's core membership of insane, gin-pickled, gout-stricken retired wing commanders. Robin, in principle, is this necessarily a bad idea just because the Conservative Party has had it?
No. The principle is actually very simple. Governments should not own newspapers. Domestic governments, foreign governments, I think the rule is the same. If you believe in a free press, if you believe in a democratic society, then you do not think that the government should control the media. I don't at all like the idea of a foreign government owning a British media organisation.
Not even if it was a nice foreign government?
No, not even if it was a nice foreign government. I don't think foreign governments should own the people who provide my electricity or my water or my bus or my train, but they do. I don't like other people's governments having a say in the way in which my services are provided. So, no, I think it's right that there shouldn't be foreign governments owning British media, and it's one thing which I believe this Conservative government is likely to get right.
Marta, why do you think, though, the Conservative government is choosing to take a stand on this now? I grant that Rupert Murdoch was not a foreign state, although he would go on to become probably more powerful than quite a lot of foreign states. But the Tories of that period did not seem notably bothered by this Australian upstart buying the Sun and the Times, among other things.
He's not a state. No matter how important he is, you don't have to worry quite as much about him as you do about, say, a hostile state taking control of your media, or at least having a particularly vocal position in it. So I think in terms of lobbying, of course, Murdoch has a lot of power. But we can be sort of comfortable with that, because there are ways in some case to prosecute him if you have to. If it's UAE or Saudi Arabia that you're trying to prosecute, you might have a much bigger problem.
And sending in a gunboat for reasons we were previously discussing is probably not feasible either. Robin, crazed libertarian analysis of the situation here. Should the readers of The Telegraph not be trusted to make up their own minds whether they're happy to read a newspaper owned by a UAE-backed interest?
That's a revolutionary idea. Readers should have some say in the way in which their newspapers are...
Well, I mean, they can choose to stop buying it.
I thought the revolutionary idea was readers thinking.
Well, I mean, you know, if we're going to talk specifically about the Daily Telegraph, its readers tend to be elderly. They are dying off. If we talk about newspapers more generally, newspaper readership is falling off a cliff. The way in which people get their news these days is much more fractured than was the case when newspapers like the Daily Telegraph had real power. I mean, you make a good point, Andrew. I think there is as much concern about this because it is the favoured newspaper of the Conservative Party, mm-hmm. and a large number of Conservatives don't like the idea that a foreign country will own their newspaper of choice.
Just finally on this one, Marta, you know, the credit where due variety question, is there an imaginable, pure-hearted, non-sinister reason why the UAE would be interested in acquiring some say over the Daily Telegraph and the Spectator?
I don't think so.
I thought you might say something of that sort. And to what might be a partial answer to the question of what was transpiring behind the scenes at the recent annual and rigidly opaque conclave? I was doing so well. Conclave of China's principal decision-making bodies. It says here that many of the delegates who attended the two sessions were gripped by a card game called Guandan, which apparently translates as throwing eggs. Apologies to any Chinese listeners if I've stressed the wrong syllable and said something terrible about their mother. The game has apparently taken China by storm, and familiarity with Guandan... Am I going to do a familiarity with your mother joke? I am not. Is said by this one entire article on the subject I have read to now be an essential political and social lubricant in the People's Republic. We don't have the requisite two decks of cards to hand, nor the rules of this game, and an inexcusable dereliction for which I apologise. Is there anything, though, Robin, do you think, to the idea that card games and politics are transferable skills?
I'm adding this to the list of reasons why I am unlikely to have a future in the Chinese Communist Party. It's quite a long list anyway. I am the world's worst card player, mainly because I'm not interested in card games. I would not do
If you could persuade other people at the table you weren't interested, though, that might actually work for you.
I might do, I suppose. I've never been persuaded that playing games is a socially useful thing to do. I'm one of these people who like sort of sitting around talking to people rather than throwing cards onto a table or rolling dice or watching horses race around a track or even, if I may say so in this company, kicking a ball around. But no, look, if Chinese communists think that the way to get ahead is to play this particular game rather than playing golf, which seems to be the favoured way of getting on in life in the Western world, well, so be it.
There is a thing as well, though, Marta, of politicians posing intently next to chessboards. And on the subject of seamless plugs, we once made a whole episode of The Foreign Desk about the overlap between chess and politics. And one of the people we spoke to was Dana Resnica Odzola, who was the Minister of Finance of Latvia and also a grandmaster. So she gets a pass. She is allowed posed with all the chessboards she wants. But does anyone, do you think, buy the idea that the politician standing next to a chessboard is an intellectual giant?
That's the point. There's no way for you to know. And that works wonderfully. It's you with Rishi Sunak at a gas pump, at a gas station, you can tell that he has no idea what he's doing. Mm-hmm. You can't really tell unless you actually know how to play chess and unless you're actually looking at them doing it. So it is a less familiar activity, which means that one might be inclined to actually believe it. Now, whether chess still has the mystique that it once had, that's something I'm not so sure of. But
the best chess players these days seem to be 10 years old anyway.
True.
Well, I don't know what that proves, but it probably proves something.
Just finally, Marta, Robin has already outed himself as a non-board game / card game player. I'm glad I finished that sentence quickly. Are you actually secretly any good or especially interested in any such pastimes?
I do enjoy a good match of cards at Christmas with people. I can get very competitive. But I don't like to think when I'm playing cards. So I am I'm generally in favor of card games that rely a lot more on luck than they do on strategy.
Marta Lorimer and Robin Lustig, thank you both very much for joining us. And finally, on today's Daily, we are in Cannes, where the world's leading property fair, MIPIM, is currently taking place. Over 20,000 people are attending, from investors to developers, civic leaders to activists. While this is an event ripe for business deals and to talk numbers, it also provides an opportunity to address core challenges the industry is currently facing, one of them obviously being the housing crisis. Monocle's Carlotta Ribello caught up with Kelsey Crawford, co-founder of Cutwork Architecture Studio, dedicated to reimagining the concept of co-living and the spaces we call home. Let's have a listen.
Cutwork was founded in 2016 around the idea that together has changed. So we're fascinated and driven to explore how evolving family structures are influencing housing, in particular how with things like the fall of the traditional family, where we see that traditional family, which is described as two parents, 2.5 kids, in some major cities such as Munich, for example, make up less than 15% of all households. Yet what we continue to produce are a housing stock built for a traditional family in an era where the traditional family is changing. And we're convinced and driving towards a future where there's much more exploration in housing typology, there's much more flexibility, and really imagining how people move through different life cycles, whether it's single and first job living in a city where you need access to easy housing that's flexible lease, that's in and out, usually fully furnished, whether it's community-oriented family housing for parents who want to raise kids together, whether it's housing for recently divorced couples who need a place to land after something very traumatic like a family separation, intergenerational housing, empty nester housing is what we're calling it, or new ager category, where elders who, you know, from 60 and up find themselves in homes that are outsized for themselves, often separated from family or loved ones, and who desire to live surrounded by people and live in community, but there's just so few options. So I think we really believe in a future where these voices aren't so marginalized, and where we see that just under the surface, you know, it's not like these types of housing need to be invented per se, they just need to be acknowledged and they need to be designed for.
Now, let's talk about in practical terms how that is translating into work. So talk to us about, for example, I know that you just have done a project that focused on co-living for single parents, for example. How did that come about and why is it important to have that social aspect to your work too?
So the concept of the co-living for single parent families is a concept by a French operator called Commune. And their vision is really to provide housing solutions to people who are very fragilized by divorce. And in particular, we see that it's the number one factor of poverty. Because as you can imagine, you go from a household where you have two usually gainfully employed individuals who were sharing a rent and sharing the cost of living to having now two households with one breadwinner. And you can just very quickly do the math. I mean, it's devastating financially for many couples. That also forces people to stay together longer when they shouldn't be, maybe. Housing is a very constrictive element around relationships for many, many couples. And we see that divorce rates are like 50% in Europe now. And you can see that being able to design housing models or products for people who are in specific periods of life, people who are in specific life cycles, makes a lot of sense. Because then when you look at a building like a one of Commune, all of the services are catered towards parents who need support. So you have shared babysitting, you have shared meal rotations, you can have cooking support, homework support for kids after, there's common playrooms. And I think that's what's interesting, is that developers are waking up and realizing there's many opportunities to design niche housing products like that, that will serve a larger audience.
When I was looking through your website, Cutwork's website, one of the things you say is that you design for social interactions. And all of this conversation and the topic of co-living goes back to also a social issue in our cities, which is loneliness. We're seeing that on the rise, particularly among younger people. And it seems the bigger the city, the more sharp that reality is. So what are some of the ways in which we can help fight that loneliness in urban areas? And can you design a way out of loneliness? I guess that's my question.
I would love to design a way out of loneliness for people. This seems like a very noble cause of architecture and design. But, you know, I think one of the interesting things that a project like Co-Living offers, and maybe I'll just preface that with, I think co-living is getting a bit of a bad rap, and I think that it's a term that can be expanded. I prefer shared housing. I prefer neighborhood design. I prefer thinking about how we can design our spaces in our cities so that it's easy for people to be social with each other and to allow these feelings of connectedness while also being able to be alone. And one of the most important tenets that we have in our design is that it's only possible to be together if it's also possible to be alone. So there's a very fine balance between being able to design social spaces and areas in buildings, within a floor of a building, within the building itself. We kind of imagine these as like three different levels of intimacy. So you have your private dwelling, which is compact, reduced space, typically with a kitchenette, where you're fully independent to do your daily life. But there's a larger shared kitchen on a main floor that's shared with maybe 15 residents. 12 to 15 is a really nice number. And a living space, a common living space, is also given. And then ground floor and rooftop are also very porous, open to the community, but also open to the residents, where there's this mix that can happen, where people can meet each other. And you can kind of choose your level of intimacy. If you're feeling super social, you know, you can hang out all day in the cafe. And I think this idea of social design, of designing for different types of social experiences, designing for temporality, so different times of the day, you know, how can a space be used and reused differently if it's a weekday or a weekend, if it's the morning or the evening. And I think here we can begin to get really efficient in how we design space if we think about layering the usages and also the time to create much more efficient, compact, usable spaces where you actually incentivize and give people opportunities to meet and connect.
That was Kelsey Crawford of Cutwork Studio speaking with Monocle's Carlotta Ribello in Cannes. To hear more from MIPIM, listen to tonight's premiere of The Urbanist at 20:00 London time. That's all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Robin Lustig and Marta Lorimer. Today's show was produced by Emma Searle and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Lily Austin. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.